Hi, this is Andrew, and this is Keynote, the daily now.tv chat show with some of the world's leading thinkers and writers. Hello, everybody. In the hall of shame of American corporate political dysfunctionality, I don't think anything really competes with the medical industry, although perhaps universities do a pretty good job. One man who's been following the dysfunctional nature of the American medical industry, of the healthcare system, has been a guest several times before on the show. Robert Pearl, MD, is a real insider. He was the CEO of Kaiser Permanente, a California-based insurance network that, in my view at least, is the best one I've experienced. He's written many books. He was on, I think we first met in 2021 when he explained to me how the culture of medicine kills both patients and doctors. That was a conversation associated with his book then at the time, a new book, Uncaring. And then recently he was on talking about how the American healthcare system has an existential crisis. It's deeply resistant, in his view, to all forms of innovation, but perhaps not all forms of innovation, because Robert Pearl has cheered up when it comes to the nature of the American healthcare system. And he has a new book out, self-published. It's actually co-authored with ChatGPT. It's called ChatGPT-MD, and Robert is joining us from California. Robert, congratulations on the new book. Are you cheering yourself up? All this new technology, is it making you more hopeful about the future of American medicine?
Hey, Andrew, it's great to be back with you. The answer is yes, but I want to put into a context. 1932, the government organizes what's called the CCMC, the Committee for the Control of Medical Costs. They're looking at what needs to happen to drive improvements, and they offer a couple of ideas around prepayment and around integration of care delivery. Past 10 years, you and I have both been looking at healthcare, looking at ways for it to improve, and I think a little has happened. Life expectancy has languished. It's no better than it was in 2010. 400,000 people die every year from misdiagnoses, 250,000 medical errors. 60% of doctors are burned out. 70% of patients say major revisions in the system have to happen. And I asked myself, why? Why is so little progress happening? And I came to realize we just haven't had the tool. And now we do. 2 years ago, OpenAI released ChatGPT-MD, ChatGPT, the book ChatGPT-MD, with all profits going to Doctors Without Borders, a wonderful charity. And now we have, I believe, a tool to accomplish it. So I'm optimistic that now that we can do it, we will.
Well, it's good news, and it makes sense. But explain, before we get to the fix, or how ChatGPT or AI in general, because your book is not an advertisement for OpenAI or ChatGPT, as perhaps you will explain later. You've tried a lot of the other systems, and for you, they all work reasonably well. What is the biggest problem? Why, and this was last year, why have you always argued that the medical industry is so resistant to innovation, and how is ChatGPT different from any other technology? We've had the internet, and the healthcare system doesn't seem to have improved.
So you're asking multiple questions. I'll try to answer them all. If I leave one out, remind me. The first thing about ChatGPT that's different is it provides expertise to the patient, not just knowledge. Those are people who have used generative AI. And as you say, I say ChatGPT because it blends well with MD as a title of the book. It's really all the generative AI applications. And they're very different than other technologies overall and other, by the way, AI tools. I differentiate generative AI from what's called narrow or rule-based AI, the two previous forms that are well described in the book itself. And so what's different about it is it provides expertise. It can help someone without an art background paint like Rembrandt. It can allow someone who doesn't play an instrument to compose songs like Drake. It can allow someone to program a computer, even though they've never taken an IT course. And it will allow people to have expertise at making diagnoses, managing chronic diseases, and becoming, I'll say, expert. I don't mean they can become physicians able to prescribe medications, but they will be able to make these diagnoses, understand the tests that need to be done to reach a final conclusion, the treatments to be provided. And that is completely unique. That's why it's subtitled, How AI Empowered Patients and Doctors, because they got to do it together, will take back control of American medicine. And this is unique. I can't find another time in history when this has been provided. You can go all the way back to the Gutenberg Bible, provided a huge amount of information. It was really powerful. It created universities, libraries, and as you say, the internet created access to information. But you go to Google and you click on a link, you can get general advice. You don't know what to do with it. With a generative AI tool, and as you say, it could be the one from OpenAI and Microsoft, or it could be the one Claude, or it could be the one that's Gemini from Google. What you now have is the ability to do something you couldn't do in the past, and that, I think, will shift how medicine is practiced, and I believe it will improve the doctor-patient relationship if both doctors and patients are willing to use it.
We heard the same promises, maybe not in terms of medicine, but more broadly in terms of the internet. Both the first chapter of internet innovation, the internet 1.0, the internet of Amazon and NewYorkTimes.com, and then, of course, the web 2.0 revolution, the same promise of democratization, of universal access to knowledge. It didn't happen. You mentioned that this system can... technology that can allow everyone to create songs of the quality of Drake and other creative artists. But a lot of creative artists and writers are now suing OpenAI. New York Times is suing OpenAI. So why would doctors, physicians, hospitals, medical systems, why would they give out their knowledge for free to OpenAI? And aren't we on the brink of an avalanche of lawsuits between companies like OpenAI and your industry, the healthcare industry?
So you always ask a lot of questions, Andrew, and I got to try and pull them apart to be able to answer people back. So the answer is yes, there are a lot of lawsuits out there. Most of them are the fact that OpenAI and other companies have taken their information and not paid them for it. So it's a legal suit over money, which doesn't surprise me. But when it comes to healthcare, the reason is that today's system is unsustainable. According to the federal government, our nation's going to spend $3 trillion more dollars a year starting in 2031, a mere 7 years from now. It's just not possible. And what's going to happen is that the pressure on clinicians to see more patients every day, to rush through the care they do, to not give the most expensive and cutting edge treatments, is only going to grow. And already 60% of clinicians are burned out, dissatisfied, unfulfilled. So it's going to be a question of everything else has been tried, and now technology offers the solution. But you're raising a very important point, one we've talked about in the past. My belief is that the transactional nature of fee-for-service medicine does just what it does. It increases volume. It's pay for volume. The more you do, the more you get paid. How many, if it does any good, doesn't matter. You get paid the same. In fact, if you make a mistake, you get paid twice. Once to make the mistake and once to do it. It is a broken system that maybe worked in the last century when the diseases people got were acute, appendicitis, pneumonia. You treated the patient, they got better, you got paid. It doesn't work with what doctors face today, which is chronic disease. You have diabetes, I'm going to see you 3-4 times a year for the rest of your life. That's a very different circumstance. And so generative AI, the way it's going to be able to achieve lower cost is not by cutting back. It's going to be by providing better quality, better clinical outcomes, greater convenience, and allowing people to avoid heart attacks, strokes, and cancer. Imagine if 30% of the heart attacks, strokes, and cancer in the United States never happened. What would happen to healthcare costs? So now you say to me, okay, Robbie, I get it, but what about people's response to it? And you're absolutely right. We've got to move to a capitated form. Call it value-based care, prepayment, pay for value, lots of different names. Because now what happens is that when the clinician keeps you healthy, that individual does better. And what I'm seeing right now is that medicine is becoming less and less satisfying because it is like running on a treadmill faster and faster and faster every year. And now all of a sudden we have a tool to improve the health of people, to avoid complications from chronic disease, to avoid the chronic diseases as diabetes, hypertension, asthma in the first place. And when that's in place and people are doing it and they're getting rewarded, and now they have more time for a patient, I predict it'll be better for both the providers of care and the recipients. And I think it will reattach and reconnect people to the mission and purpose that made them choose healthcare for the profession in the first place.
Robbie, how is this going to affect the insurance industry, which is at the heart, it seems to me, and you have an enormous amount of experience of this, at the heart of the dysfunctional system? How can AI make the healthcare insurance system more efficient? Is that what you're talking about, a value-based care? Will it mean that insurance costs will come down, or will they become more specific?
If you look at insurance costs, there are three ways that most of insurance is provided in the United States, and they actually are about a third, and a third. You have a third of the people who are insured through their employer, who purchases an insurance from United Healthcare or one of the Blues or one of the other major insurance companies. You have about a third of the time that the company itself provides the coverage, and they use one of the insurance companies to do the administrative functions. And you have a third of the time the government pays in terms of just raw numbers. So when you look at those, how will it impact it? I think it will help all of them. And as you note, it will bring down the cost of care for two reasons. Because by moving from a transactional fee-for-service basis, where 10% of the total cost is just administrative overhead, with the insurance companies reviewing the care being done, deciding whether to authorize the care, battling doctors and taking time to justify it, making sure that the electronic health record is essentially being used simply to document in order to get paid. These are really problematic aspects. And when you move to that, to a capitated form, I think it benefits everyone. It's not to say there aren't any problems at all, but it benefits people because it takes out that 10% of transactional cost. And on top of all of that, what it's going to be able to accomplish is to give a guaranteed price. So imagine you're a company, you have a bunch of workers and you'd like to insure them. You're very well motivated. Wouldn't you like to know what it's going to cost you this year? And if you're an insurance company now, you can basically transfer that risk onto the delivery system. Now, why is that so important? Because that's where the limiting step has been from my perspective. It's not the insurers who haven't wanted to do it. It's the doctors and hospitals. Because in any given year, they could be in big trouble if, for let's say, a flu epidemic comes around and they haven't had the tool necessary to be able to provide that care at a high quality level, but at a cost that's affordable. That's what I think is changing now. So I think they will like it. They will be the intermediaries. They'll sell the products. They won't need as much margin, and they won't have to put as much downward pressure on the care delivery side. Instead, they'll be able to essentially compare performance on quality measures and patient satisfaction across the industry, signing up those who do well and leaving behind those who don't. And that is what is needed, I think, in the 21st century, particularly, as I said earlier, with chronic disease affecting 60% of Americans and accounting for 70% of the cost.
Robbie, as I mentioned earlier, used to be CEO of Kaiser Permanente, one of the insurance networks, a very good one in my view in Northern California. Amazon, of course, have radically disrupted, revolutionized American retail. Fintech companies like PayPal are in the process of revolutionizing American finance. Is it going to require new startups in the medical AI space? Or are the current insurance companies, the Blues, as you call them, and the Kaiser Permanentes, do they have the innovative capacity, the imagination, the daring, the ability to take risks, to shake their own industry up? I somehow doubt it.
You're raising a really important part. And I think I like to think of this as the incumbents, and they are linked together in a way. Actually, it's hard to pull out one piece because you need all the different pieces. You need the insurer, you need the hospital, you need the clinicians. And what you're raising is a very important part, and you and I have talked about in the past, which is that if the change is not driven by the incumbents, then there will be disruption by the Amazon, CVS, the Walmart. Organizations that are amassing all the pieces right now, they have the pharmacies, they're purchasing primary care groups, they'll be hiring specialists, they are offering insurance products. So this battle is definitely going to be happening. But I don't know about you, Andrew, but I had a situation the other day where I was trying to make a little bit of a home improvement product happen, and I needed a particular supply. And I said, you know, the place I can go buy it, it's 30 minutes away. So I really want to drive half an hour, drive back a half an hour. So I went to Amazon. There it was. It was at a great price. I'm a Prime member. They delivered it the next day. The quality was excellent. Where in healthcare today can you get that convenience?
And why? Yeah, you're asking me. I mean, you know, the astonishing thing, Robbie, to me about, there's only one industry I know in my own experience that still uses the telephone, and that's healthcare. Doctors and their assistants, and there's this Byzantine, sort of almost Kafkaesque-style bureaucracy around these doctors. They still use the telephone because they can get away with it. Nobody else would allow anyone to pick the phone up. It's the most inefficient kind of technology that only really old people or doctors, or at least healthcare professionals, seem to use. So these people have to be forced into becoming more innovative. Otherwise, they just fall back on being more and more inefficient and more unaccountable, don't they?
Well, and you're absolutely right. You already mentioned the fact that the number one way that clinicians exchange vital information is with a fax machine.
And are you serious?
Yeah.
So you're the only industry still uses the fax as well. That's absurd.
When I tell my students at the Stanford Graduate School of Business about the fact they use the fax machine, they look at me and say, "What's a fax machine?" They've never seen one. They don't know how it works. Absolutely. So what you're describing is an industry stuck in the past, and we could spend an entire show talking about how that happens. The university, as you said at your introduction, is another prime example of that. We'll skip that for the current time moment, if that's okay. But you're right. So, you know, I don't know whether it's going to come from inside the industry or the outside of the industry, but I know that it's going to come. And this is the history of technology. You know, it's, as you pointed out, Clay Christensen, a brilliant man who unfortunately died a couple of years ago, you know, he talked about disruptive innovation, that if the incumbents don't change, Kodak is a great example. You know, it had the filmless camera long before the iPhone came around. They didn't want to do it because they liked selling film. Yeah, big margin. Same is going to happen in healthcare.
So it seems to me, here's the really interesting question is, because of Obamacare, because of all the government initiatives in healthcare, and because of the demand for perhaps among some people for a single payer system or other demands to give people more access, Medicare, Medicaid, Is the government inadvertently a defender of the status quo? Should the government simply retreat from every aspect of healthcare? Might that trigger more change?
The government is both a maintainer as well as actually an innovator. As hard as that is to believe, Medicare Advantage is a good example of that, a capitated form. And most of the improvements that have happened through that system. But the government is the government, and to expect anything radical to come out of Congress is unlikely given the political deadlock that exists there at the current time. No, I don't think it's a question of that. I just think the whole system is left over from a previous time period when it was appropriate. You know, it might have been a really good way to take care of someone with an acute appendicitis. You know, you have a hospital, they come to the emergency room, they're diagnosed, they go to the operating room, they recover and they go home and it's all done. It's just not a good way to take care of the problems of today. And so we just keep adding on costs on top of the old costs. And so I think the whole system, the government to me is just part of the system. And whether that stays there or whether it gets disrupted. And by the way, when disruption comes, the government may figure out a way to leverage the cost and transfer it onto the system, and the more efficient system will displace the traditional one that sits there. Now, let me give you some examples, if I could, Andrew. You know, it's 11 o'clock at night. You have a young child. They have 102 fever. What should you do? You know, on one hand, you can go to the ER where you'll wait an hour or two and they'll be surrounded by people coughing. Or alternatively, you can wait till the morning, but you're afraid your child could die from meningitis. So you call the doctor's office, and what do you find? A recorded message that tells you, go to the ER. Now, why is that message there? Because it protects the clinician. Or you call the answering service. They say, they'll call you back in the morning. You don't have an answer. There's no way to get the information you need.
And on top of all that, and I've been in this situation. I'm sure many of our viewers and listeners have. You're in a situation where you're also nervous about the cost. If you take your child to the ER, it's going to cost you thousands, sometimes tens of thousands of dollars. And you're worried, well, is this really worth it? Are they seriously ill?
So right now you have nothing, and generative AI will give you the advice. And the more information you put in there, your family history, laboratory, medications, your whole genetic sequence, it can personalize that. It's not general information, it's personalized. Go to chronic disease. We said earlier, 60% of Americans have it. We have wearable devices that can monitor your blood pressure, your pulse, your blood glucose, all these different parameters that we follow. And what do we do with that information? We have nothing that we can do with it. The patient can't interpret it. They're not a clinician. Send it to your doctor's office. It's the last thing they want. Their systems are already overwhelmed. Bring it to your visit. They don't want to see 5 pages of blood glucose measurements 4 times a day. We have a technology now that can analyze it, tell you how you're doing, instruct you when more
light was. This is so painful, Robert. I'm going to have to call my doctor, although, of course, he'll never call me back. I want to come to a break in a second, and after the break, I want to talk specifically about the new book. But before we get there, you talked about the old system. You might describe it as a technocracy, one where doctors are fetishized. You know this better than anyone. They're the ones who are impossible to access. They have this bureaucracy cushioning them. When you get to talk to them, they're very accessible and very smart and very helpful, but they're almost impossible to get hold of. You teach at Stanford Medical School, your wife is a surgeon. How is all this going to change the business of being a doctor? Is it going to make it easier? Your book on caring speaks of how the current system is not just killing patients, it's killing doctors.
I think it's going to improve it because, you know, as a clinician, I always want to start with a diagnosis. What is really problematic about the delivery of healthcare today? And my diagnosis is that the people providing it don't have the time. Everything you're describing is a symptom of that. Why is that? Because as the cost pressures have risen, the pressure from insurers are coming down, physicians are being asked to see more patients every day, the average visit's down to 17 minutes. So when I diagnose the problem, I say, why do they have so little time? And I think it's this chronic disease problem. Because as I said earlier, you have appendicitis, I see you over a couple of weeks and then I'm done seeing you. You have diabetes, I see you 3-4 times a year. for the rest of your life. We haven't realized the added cost. That is why this generative AI technology is so powerful, because it can help manage that. I think it could do probably 20% of what happens in doctor's offices today in the patient's home. And now when you come in, the clinician has the time. And right now, all doctors can do is to protect themselves. The demands are so excessive. But as I mentioned earlier, we need an economic system to support that technological solution. And when you put the two together, I think it's actually will be the cure for many of them, for the malaise and for the burnout that is so prevalent in medicine today. Getting from here to there, however, as in every change process, is a little scary, requires courage. It has risks, it has change. And my observation is medicine has been a resistant profession to taking risk. And I think the time has now come, and I'm hopeful that as the pressures have grown, skilled leaders will step forward. The book, ChatGPT MD, has 5 parts.
And we'll get to the book in a second. Just briefly before we get to the book, and I want to take a break before the book, Robbie, what about changes in patient culture? Everybody knows that that is also a huge problem. You only have to pick up the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post, or the New York Times, or the CNN, or any of the other reasonably serious, credible publications to read something about the importance of exercise, of weight loss, of not drinking too much. And yet all these things are on the rise. So how can we trust ordinary Americans, not doctors like yourself or healthcare nuts, insiders, how can we ensure that people will pay any more attention to their ChatGPT doctor, their OpenAI powered doctor, than they do to their current doctor?
Maybe I'm a bit more optimistic than you about the patient. When I look at people, I see individuals who are managing their finances without having to go through a traditional stock broker. They're arranging travel around the globe without having to go to a travel agent. They are managing their banking, taking their checks, downloading them into their accounts, moving money back and forth, paying with Venmo. We could go down the whole list of things. The most common way, the most common application people are using now, YouTube for do-it-yourself projects. I think we've underestimated. We just haven't given them the tools. That's how I see it. Now, some of the things you're describing, like the exercise and the diet, they're hard. And ChatGPT and other generative AI tools will give people expertise. You want to have a better diet? You can put the information in place. You'll get a shopping list. You'll get recipes. You'll get things that are going to be nutritious. It will remind you to exercise. And some of it is just building into your day. And people also don't have enough time in their life. Just like clinicians, we're running out of time. And what do we cut back on? The things that are not the crisis in the moment. And so you're describing a lot of pieces there, but I don't think the patients are going to hesitate once we give them a tool that's reliable. Interesting data came out today, actually, that on the willingness of doctors and clinicians to use generative AI for health needs, and we're seeing it go up, by the way, particularly amongst clinicians. 40% of clinicians are already building it into their practice. And again, I want to emphasize for listeners and viewers, I do not believe that what's available today should be used without the help of a physician. But at the same time, I strongly believe that by 5 years from now, when this tool becomes better every year and it's 30 times more powerful, no one will be able to achieve the best health outcomes without using a generative AI application.
It will be irresistible, at least according to Robert Pearl, the co-author of ChatGPT MD. I'll take a short break, then I'm going to talk about his new book, which he wrote in association with a certain ChatGPT. So we'll be back in a second. I want to remind everyone that great guests like Robert Pearl are brought to us by our friends at Liberty, a quarterly journal of culture and politics. Wonderful new publication, trying to enlighten us about the world. Going to run a short piece on liberties, and then we'll be back with Robert Pearl to talk about his new co-authored book, ChatGPT MD. Don't go away anyway. Don't go away, anyone. Don't call your doctor.
news, the noise, there is nuance, insight. Liberty's is not just a journal of ideas. It's a meteor of intelligent substance. It's the place to be for engaged citizens. Politics, opinion, substance. Liberty's is a triumph for freedom of thought. A quarterly of urgency, of cultural exploration, of intellectual delight, of immaculate prose. It's invaluable. Subscribe now or find Liberty's at your favorite bookseller.
And you can subscribe to Liberty's at libertiesjournal.com. We're speaking with my old friend, Robert Pearl, MD, the co-author of ChatGPT MD. First time, Robbie, we met. You were the author, not the co-author of Uncaring. This book was written with ChatGPT in association. What was that like?
Last fall, when I fully grasped the impact that generative AI would have, and I realized that I had to help both patients, clinicians, and national societies to start moving forward. As I said in the first segment, not to use it in place of doctors and nurses and other individuals, but as a way to gain expertise, to find out more, to get care more conveniently, 24/7, be able to get care when you're not sure what's there. So I wanted to make things happen. But I also realized that the exponential growth, and we said earlier that it's going to be 30 times more powerful in 5 years. Imagine if your car could go 30 times as fast as an airplane. You'd say that's impossible, and yet that's what's about to happen, assuming the technology stays on the course that it is there. But I realized that if I took the usual 2 years, both my first two books were done through a traditional publisher, traditional publishing mechanism. And between the completion of the book and the actual availability, it's 6 months. The whole process takes 2 years. By 2 years from now, anything that I wrote would be out of date. So I wanted to do something quickly, but yet with the same quality. And I said, if I'm going to be writing and recommending ChatGPT for medical care, I should try it in the journalistic world. So in many ways, this whole journey has been one of experimentation and exploration. So I started writing. I took 1.2 million words that I had published and written and had to enter it into the application. Then I had to go back and forth, hundreds and hundreds of prompts, probably thousands of prompts, being able to provide a draft, get feedback, provide feedback. In many ways, it was like working with a skilled editor, getting perceptions, perspectives to each piece that I was creating. And yet at the same time, I'll tell you, Andrew, there were a lot of frustrations. And if I had even waited 6 months, I would have had an easier task since I started the book. Again, only 6 months ago, OpenAI has released what's called plugins. They use the word because it's like it sounds. You plug it in to connect to information. It's actually called GPTs. It doesn't actually happen with a plug. It happens with Bluetooth and wireless. But all those things being said, I could have entered the data a lot easier. And number two, the memory was only capable of storing 25,000 words. And I needed 1.2 million. You can imagine how long that would take. And both of those things have now happened. And I'll add one more piece, which is that on occasion it hallucinated. It came up with an entirely amazing journey to the North Pole and the leadership skills required, not a single drop of which could I find anywhere in my research. And so one of the long parts of the book, it's almost 40 pages, is the bibliography, where every fact that ChatGPT gave me, I had to check out and make sure I could document. But in the end, it was a positive experience. The book, I think, is far better as a result of that. I'd say probably 80% of the book I wrote. I did leave one chapter that ChatGPT wrote, almost all of it, about 90%, clearly documented and highlighted for the reader. And there are other chapters that I wrote almost entirely by myself. But putting it together, it was a great collaboration. And I think the outcome, both from a time perspective and from a literary expertise, I think it justified it. I think it's also going to set a standard for publication, not just for medical care.
In a sense, Robbie, it's a call to arms. You're talking about how AI-empowered patients and doctors can take back control of American medicine. How did you find working with OpenAI in terms of the writing of a manifesto? It's all very well listing the facts. I don't doubt that it's capable of dealing with huge amounts of data. But what about putting it in the kind of language that will actually trigger people to go out and take back control of American medicine? Because this isn't just going to happen because you think it should happen. It's going to require human beings. And we are blood and flesh. We're not driven by chips.
Well, as I said earlier, I have no relationship to OpenAI or any of the other companies.
No, I take your point, and you just used OpenAI because it was convenient. It was it's a leader, but you could have just as easily used the Google Gemini. So I accept that. But in any event, whichever system you worked with would have required you to put this into a manifesto that will inspire people to go out and seize back control of this industry that everybody, industry, patients, politicians, we're all deeply unhappy with, and yet we don't know how to change it.
Yeah, well, first of all, I'll say that the application was more conservative than I was. Now, the reason is because the people who create it through what's called parameters, the transformers that take the pre-training and convert it to a generative AI solution, program it as such. So it was not prompting me to be more aggressive, anything slowing it down. But I think the process and the interaction worked well. The real question is, how do we motivate people? It's why I wrote the book. I think people have to see that if they don't do something, medicine's not going to get better. And 70% of patients think the system is really broken.
I take your point, and no one's going to argue with that. But my question is about the ability of since you co-authored this book with ChatGPT, what about it as a prose stylist, as the builder of a narrative that can actually affect people? Was it doing stuff in terms of your experience writing with it? Was it making arguments and using language that you hadn't thought of?
I think it was more providing a broader background and a set of information than I was aware of. Not that I couldn't have found it with extensive research, but that's part of how we shrunk down the time from concept to delivery. So I don't think it's that. And if anything, the current versions are a little weak when it comes to verb forms. So I don't think it's a question of it. You know, I wrote most of it, but it was a co-author creating, contributing to it. But there were times it opened my eyes, it created new ideas. There were times when I'd say, you know, I'd like to write this a little bit more humorously or a little bit more seriously, or I'd like to write this particular section for a 8th grader or a 10th grader, not for a PhD. And so it allowed that to happen much more quicker. It does that very, very well. But, you know, I think the idea of the current version replacing people, whether it's the delivery of care or the writing of books, that's not going to happen today at the high level of quality. But I often say in medicine, in the future, and by that I mean the near future, 3 to 5 years, the combination of clinician plus technology will be better than the best clinicians. And it wouldn't surprise me, at least in the nonfiction arena, that the combination of the writer plus a generative AI tool will be better than the best nonfiction writers at creating a book that's excellent from a quality standpoint and a literary standpoint in a shorter time frame.
Yeah, and the publishing business may not be quite as archaic or as rotten as the medical industry, but it's also very backward. Maybe they can learn from this. What about, Robbie, what did the experience teach you about the value of human beings? Many, many books, many conversations about, we've had on this show, and they will go on and on throughout the rest of the century, about what human beings are supposed to do in the age of the smart machine. What did writing this book with ChatGPT teach you about the value of humans, of doctors in the future of medicine?
Well, I have a deep belief that the human patient connection is going to be vital forever. Well, forever is a long time. Who knows what's going to happen, decades and centuries from now, but at least for the foreseeable future, that human to human relationship is going to be crucial. But what I also see, Andrew, and I think this is so important for listeners and viewers to realize, is that what we do today is not working. So it's not that the doctor-patient relationship couldn't be great if both parties had the time, but they don't have the time. And so what is done now is not as good. There was a great piece of research done by the University of Arizona where they took emails, text messages that patients had sent. They took them, they gave them to two groups. They gave them first to a bunch of clinicians. They gave it to a bunch of, to the generative AI application. They took the responses and they gave it to an entire new audience to evaluate for two things. These were both clinicians in one hand and patients who were not clinicians in the other. And they said, how accurate is it? And how empathetic is it? And surprisingly, the technology of generative AI was viewed to be four times as accurate and nine times as compassionate. Now, why is that? How could a machine be more compassionate than a person? The problem is time. We do not have the time. And what has great technology done across centuries? In just about every part of our life, it creates time. And that's what I think is necessary and why I'm excited. My excitement is really about the human side and how the technology can create the time that clinicians can now delve deeper into the problems that patients have. They can feel like they've done a better job. They haven't had to cut corners and go home at night with less burnout. And patients can feel as though they have the knowledge they need to ask the right questions and to leave the doctor's office with the understanding required of the recommendations the clinician has made.